So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy. The point has been made, there will be a realisation in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The tea break young girls working at the Central Market in the heart of New Delhi. They say things have changed significantly since the December 2012 gang rape. Now the streets of Delhi are safer for women, as we can see the change. But more needs to be done, considering the population of the city. These working girls are excited to see the new pink booth launched by the Delhi police to make the city safer for girls and women.
Women are more secure nowadays. Police helpline number we are given, and I think last week they have opened several police booth, pink police booth in local market near places where we can directly complain women have.
Although the initiative started a week ago, the drive is gaining a gradual popularity across the city. The booths are staffed with all women police officers filing complaints on the spot, mainly in the crowded markets, besides helping female commuters with any sort of problems they face while shopping. The initiative has received an overwhelming response from citizens, especially on the social media. Now calls are growing across the country for similar booths for women and girls in distress, since the office provides them with the on-spot help. Indian women live in a constant barrage of threats ranging from rape, torture, abduction, stalking, domestic violence, dowry deaths and other forms of violence. The administration in recent years adopted a string of stringent measures as a result of large-scale reporting of crime against women. Experts say while violence against women in India is a deep-rooted social problem, there is a need for cultural change. Many are hopeful things are changing in a good direction. With a drive like the Pink Booth, women will get more sense of safety and security.
This is an iconic spot, India Gate. Here people from across the country and from abroad come to visit. We provide women and girls with all help and support. In case they face any troubles, their complaints are filled on spot rather than going to the police station.
New Delhi, which the media usually dubs one of the most unsafe cities for women, has seen a 21% rise in crime against women compared to the last year. Based on the city police, the rise is the result of a conscious policy of fear and truthful registration of complaints. Now, with the pink booth arrival at bustling markets, the Delhi police is confident to provide a safe complaint mechanism, besides hoping for it to be a success story. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
As missiles fell on Ukrainian cities, so did international condemnation rain down on Russia's attack on Ukraine. NATO's Secretary General reiterated the alliance's support of Ukraine.
We condemn Russia's aggressions in the strongest possible terms and call on Russia to immediately cease its military action.
A day earlier, EU leaders discussed developments the scale of which none of them would entirely have foreseen.
From their national capitals, leader after leader promised a coordinated and unprecedented sanctions response aimed at President Putin, the Russian elite, and the sources and havens of Russian wealth, the city of London being one of them.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson set diplomatic niceties aside, describing Vladimir Putin as a dictator, before outlining a raft of punitive measures.
We'll be imposing asset freezes on more than 100 new entities and individuals, on top of the hundreds that we've already announced. This includes all the major manufacturers that support Putin's war machine. Furthermore, we are also banning Aeroflot from the UK.
economic warfare at the expense of negotiation as a means of ending the Ukraine crisis.
Present government or the present arrangement in Ukraine was installed in 2014, 8 years ago. So there's been 8 years of diplomacy, 8 years of opportunities to fix these very serious problems of the national question in Ukraine and of Russian national security. And the only reason we haven't seen those happening is because of the total intransigence of the US and its allies in London, in Berlin, and in Kiev.
And while the West blames Russia for triggering the crisis, others such as Iran and China say the reason behind it should be sought elsewhere.
The US administration, the German administration had given assurances to the Soviets back in 1989, back in 1990, when the two sides were renegotiating the reunification of Germany, that NATO would not expand. You know, the famous quote is, NATO will not expand even 1 inch eastwards of Germany. 30 years later, 14 countries in Eastern and Central Europe have been incorporated into NATO, including countries like Estonia, which share a border with Russia.
The war in Ukraine is ongoing. NATO member Poland says it has opened 9 reception points along Ukraine's border to receive an expected wave of refugees, another outcome of U.S.-led NATO's adventurism. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The Omicron variant exploded in South Korea this week, with new daily cases increasing 50% to 170,000 per day. South Korea's surge in the Omicron variant of COVID-19 comes as other countries with declining cases relax lockdown measures. So despite the increase in new cases of the Omicron variant here in South Korea, the government's under increasing pressure to end social distancing restrictions and open up social and economic activity. Small business people suffering from limits in hours and capacity have rallied for an end to the restrictions. The school year begins next week. Many believe classes should go ahead in person.
Insisting on virtual classes is not realistic because we don't know when the COVID-19 pandemic will end. So the government's decision looks reasonable to me, as long as there are proper measures like vaccines for the children to minimize the risk.
Some parents' group protested against vaccine mandates for teenagers amid reports of a handful of deaths attributed to vaccinations. Doctors maintain the public health benefits of getting the jab, including resuming in-person classes at school.
For students, offline, in-person class is very important, especially for the youngest. But the danger of infection is still there, and a child's infection leads to the whole family's infection. So it's better to start with offline classes until enough of the 5 to 11-year-old age group has been vaccinated.
South Korea's medical authorities this week approved the Pfizer vaccine for young children. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In what seems to be a hefty catch, the Lebanese Internal Security Forces have thwarted a plan by Daesh terrorists to carry out 3 suicide bombings targeting religious compounds in Beirut's southern suburbs. Interior Minister Bassam al-Maulawi told reporters that had this terrorist plot not been stopped, it would have taken Lebanon to a very dangerous situation.
A Takfiri terrorist group recruited young Palestinian men in Lebanon to carry out major bombing attacks using explosive belts and using explosives which contain rocket missiles.
Lebanon's internal security forces said the instructions for the bomb plot came from a Daesh operative based in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Helwi, who is in touch with extremists in Syria. The terrorist operative was given explosive vests and other weapons to prepare for simultaneous attacks on 3 religious compounds in the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is reminiscent to a wave of attacks in the Beirut suburbs between 2013 and 2014. The instructions were passed to an undercover internal security forces agent who had successfully managed to infiltrate Daesh networks in Lebanon. Observers see that Daesh has lost initiative in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, and is trying to gain ground.
I think that ISIS is now trying to implement a qualitative operation attack in Lebanon after the death of his leader al-Qurashi in 3 February in Syria, because he lost initiative in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq.
Daesh is seemingly taking advantage of a deep financial crisis in Lebanon to attract recruits, promising them high salaries.
ISIS didn't stop trying to get inside the Lebanese society when he succeeded in to send many young men from Tripoli to Iraq. More than 49 young men have been sent to Iraq. 9 of them have been killed, targeted by the Iraqi jet 3 weeks ago. And now the information about a Palestinian cell in the Palestinian camp in Lebanon.
Al-Mawlawi uncovered that the ministry and the security apparatus are monitoring the movement of Lebanese leaving the northern city of Tripoli to join the terrorist group, and have opened talks with Iraqi authorities on this threat. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Hundreds of Afghan youths and sportsmen rallied against the U.S. in Kabul. The rally is part of massive anti-U.S. sentiments underway in the country over the recent decision by the American president to give some parts of the Afghans' national assets to the victims of the 9/11 attacks. "We want all of our money. Biden is a thief. Death to America." These are the slogans that the protesters chanted as they were holding anti-U.S. placards.
"These sportsmen call on the U.S. to reverse its decision and free all of their money. They say freezing Afghanistan's assets has harmed all aspects of the Afghan society."
"We have gathered here on behalf of all Afghan youths and sportsmen to condemn the U.S. president's decision to give half of our frozen assets to Americans. Of course, this decision is crazy and unjust. The U.S.'s move has affected all Afghans' lives. Our athletes and sportsmen are quitting their sports due to economic difficulties."
The angry protesters also say that if the U.S. does not reverse its unjust and immoral decision, their protests will escalate.
"The U.S. considers itself as one of the richest countries, but now it's shamelessly stealing from the poorest people of the world. We call on the U.S. to free all of our frozen assets and stop punishing and torturing Afghans. Our demonstrations will continue until we reach our rights."
Staging in front of the U.N. office in Kabul, the protesters called on the U.N. and World Bank donors not to stay silent against the U.S. operations and stay by Afghans' side.
"Afghans were not involved in 9/11 attack. This is crystal clear to the world countries. So why should the U.S. seek revenge from us? In addition, today Afghans are dealing with many economic and health crises. We urge the international community to make the U.S. reconsider its decision and let the flow of aid to our vulnerable people."
Last week, the U.S. president signed an order allowing half of $7 billion in Afghan frozen assets to be given to 9/11 victims. The move has sparked outrage in Afghanistan and was massively denounced. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Under a sea of red flags, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, held a big protest to mark its 53rd anniversary and support Al-Quds. People thronged the streets of Gaza City to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. Tensions heightened across the Palestinian territories in mid-February when Israeli forces and illegal settlers renewed their attacks against Palestinians in Al-Quds's Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
53 years on, the DFLP continues to hold sacred the liberation of Al-Quds and the right of return. And we will call on all Palestinians to protect Sheikh Jarrah.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine refuses to recognize the Israeli regime and maintains armed resistance as the only way to end the Israeli occupation.
Resistance is the best way to liberate Al-Quds, and we say to our people in Sheikh Jarrah that we always support them. We are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of defending Al-Quds and all of Palestine against the Zionist enemy.
DFLP activists called on all Palestinian factions to increase armed resistance against the Israeli regime and its forces. Protesters also slammed Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region for normalizing their relations with Tel Aviv.
All those countries who normalize their ties with Israel are stabbing the Palestinian people in the back and hurting our cause. Israel is using normalization as a pretext to increase its violations in Al-Quds.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
As they mark the 53rd anniversary of the DFLP, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
EU foreign affairs ministers held emergency talks on Tuesday to agree on sanctions against 351 Russian legislators who voted to give independence to two regions in eastern Ukraine. The West claims it's the beginning of an invasion. Russian financial, business and media outlets are also being singled out by the EU.
We agreed to target 27 individuals and entities who are playing a role in undermining or threatening Ukrainian territorial integrity.
The measures will result in asset freezes and travel bans.
We're limiting the Russian government's ability to raise capital on the EU's financial markets.
A new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany will, for now at least, remain closed. This despite the EU desperately needing Russia's energy. Citizens passing by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, have clearly been following developments closely.
Ukraine, of course, has been generated as a state during the Soviet period, but in a way she's consists of several areas which are very difficult to be maintained together.
Yeah, we need peace. Our economy is based on international trade, and gas is one of our main tools to survive.
The European Commission confirmed on Tuesday EU gas reserve storage tanks are currently only 30% full. The Commission is actively trying to secure alternative supply chains in order to reduce the EU's dependency on Russia. It's in contact, for example, with Japan, South Korea, Qatar, Azerbaijan and Egypt. But this is a very costly process because the energy has to be shipped in. Russia's gas is cheap and, of course, the pipelines are already in place. NATO, which has its headquarters here in Brussels, continued to ramp up the anti-Russia rhetoric after the new sanctions were announced.
We have over 100 jets at high alert, and there are more than 120 Allied ships at the sea from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Many analysts say this crisis could have been avoided if NATO had listened to Russia's legitimate security concerns. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Tuesday, the Italian Bureau of Statistics, Istat, announced Italy's inflation surged to 4.8% last month from 3.9% in December and is now at its highest since 1996. The statistical agency said its trolley index of everyday goods, such as food and household items, was up 3.2% with the Italians starting to buckle under the pressure. Price rises, Istat explained, were driven by higher energy costs.
Bread, milk, pasta, the price of every item has gone up considerably. I go shopping every day and it cannot go unnoticed.
Energy bills have gone up for a while and keeping the shop open is becoming unsustainable. In December I paid almost 100% more compared to the previous bill. I'm really concerned over what's happening in Ukraine. Should energy prices further hike, I would have to turn off the lights or shut off the shop.
Tension keeps growing at the border of the EU and Russia after Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a decree recognizing breakaway Luhansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent. Western leaders have vowed to impose severe sanctions over Moscow aimed at limiting Russia's ability to export oil and gas. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has warned that any international sanctions targeting Russia's energy industry would hit Italy badly. Unlike other major European countries, Rome is very much gas dependent, being the leading producer of electricity with this fuel in Europe.
Italy sources around 40% of its gas from Russia. As we are in February, with the warmer season fast approaching, the energy demand is set to drop a bit. It is to be hoped that the Ukraine crisis will be resolved in the next 6 to 7 months. In case it is not, the EU, which won't be self-sufficient in energy anytime soon, will have to find unity of purpose among its member states and embrace a more assertive energy strategy.
Rome has historically relatively strong commercial ties with Moscow. In recent days, Italy had announced plans for the possibility of Draghi flying to the Russian capital for talks over the Ukraine crisis with Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Economic independence is important. But first, I'd like to speak about cultural independence. In my opinion, cultural independence is the most important kind of independence. Cultural independence lies in choosing an Islamic Iranian lifestyle. 2-3 years ago, I spoke at length about lifestyle. Lifestyle includes architecture, civil life, human environment, social relationships, and different other matters. Imitating the verse and foreigners on the issue of lifestyle is the exact opposite of cultural independence. Today, global imperialism is working on this matter. The issue of engineering information and the new means of mass communication that have entered the arena are all tools for dominating the culture of a country. I'm not saying that we should throw these tools out of our lives. This is not what I'm saying. These are tools that might be beneficial. But the enemy's domination over these tools should be eliminated. For example, in order to have radio and television show, you cannot give your radio and television networks to the enemy. The same is true of the internet, of cyberspace and information services and tools. These things cannot be in the hands of the enemy. Yet today they are in his hands.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, the media network are tools and instruments for cultural infiltration. Today, they are the enemy's tools for cultural domination. And to say it briefly, economic independence is the refusal to be digested into the stomach of the global economy. Notice that they, the Americans, said after the nuclear negotiations that the nuclear deal should cause Iran's economy to merge with the global economy. Merge? What does merging mean? What is the global economy? Is the global economy a fair, reasonable, and rational system? Not at all. an economy whose plan has been formulated by the Global Committee and whose various branches are spread throughout the world, is a plan and system that has been devised mainly by Zionists, capitalists, and some non-Zionists with the purpose of usurping the economic resources of the entire world. This is the order system of the global community and the global economy. If a country merges its economy with the global economy, this is not a source of pride. Rather, it is a loss and a defeat.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's been 3 days since Russia attacked Ukraine. Moscow said today that it's already destroyed over 800 Ukrainian military targets. At the same time, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky announced that his country's capital, Kyiv, is still under Ukrainian control, despite street fighting in and around the city. In another development, the U.S. said it is providing Ukraine with $350 million worth of additional arms supplies to fight Russia. In this edition of the Spotlight, we are going to discuss why diplomacy failed, what are the reasons for the war, and take a look at the role of major players in the conflict, including the US, NATO, and the EU. My guests for Spotlight are Professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University, Vladimir Goldstein from Providence, Rhode Island. Paolo Raffoni, the CPI Foundation. He's a co-founder and the CEO there from the Belgian capital, Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. And Vladimir, if I could start with you. President Putin knew about the political and economic costs of attacking Ukraine. Why do you think that made him to attack Ukraine, and why did you do you think diplomacy failed to stop the war?
Well, I suspect that there were a lot of debates and discussions in among Russian leadership, and, you know, pro and contra. Of course, we all know all the contras, sanctions, outrage, accusations, and so on. But I imagine that Russian military and Putin himself felt that, you know, this is a question of so-called red lines, that we pleaded, asked, talked with the United States, with NATO, not to push NATO to our borders, not recognize it. Let's have it diplomatically. And if you remember, just recently, within, you know, last 2 months, there was a real flurry of diplomatic efforts to all of them. United States would say, no, 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 it's either, we don't recognize any red lines, we don't do this, we don't do that, even though we all, it's very fresh in our memories, when the Russians threatened to put nuclear arms in Cuba, you know, Kennedy was ready to go to war. So it's sort of this position of not recognizing the red lines of others and having the red lines themselves is kind of not tenuous. But in any case, you know, Putin felt that he exhausted all the possibilities, and it will be existential threat to Russia to have NATO in hostile Ukraine. By the way, during the last 8 years, there was a very relentless campaign of preparing Ukraine and educating them in Russophobia. That's another thing. So I guess Russian leadership decided, despite the drawbacks, they better put an end to that now.
Okay.
Sure.
Let me turn to our other guest, Paolo Raffaoni. Paolo, what does the military escalation in Ukraine, in your opinion, say about the US and NATO's policies towards Russia since the disintegration of the Soviet Union 30-odd years ago?
Well, there is no doubt that the way the post-Soviet space has been managed by the West since the early 90s has been perceived from Moscow very negatively. And the reason is that instead of having a sort of open dialogue to embrace the new states emerging from the Soviet Union and Russia itself into an integrated world based on cooperation and collaboration, there has been a push of expansion, not only on the military defensive, as the Western side says, military defensive side, which is NATO, but also through the EU. To a pace that has really been a sort of a de facto situation in which Russia was out of the game. And things became very clear in the 2000s. So in 2007, it was evident that finally Russia was not at all welcome to effectively join the feast of the West, as it happened, by the way, after 1945. So this has created a lot of animosity. There was an attempt in 2011 to repair to this. This didn't change the equation. On the contrary, there was the American push also in Libya, as we know, the same year. And things have been derailing and derailing over the years. So basically, this mentality of a flat world and the indefinite expansion of the hegemonic system and power from the West to the rest of the world, which started in the 90s, has completely twisted the relationship with Russia to a point where it was quite evident that Ukraine was a de facto NATO state, because it was supported unofficially, but de facto, yes, by NATO countries and NATO advisors. and also the model of democracy that was being implemented with the support of the EU in Ukraine was something that for Russia was felt like a danger to its own security. And that's why then everything derailed to the point of the war.
Okay. Vladimir, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a recent tweet that his country has been left alone by the US and the EU. I'm going to read the tweet for you. Zelensky says, "Who is ready to fight with us? I do not see anyone who is ready to give Ukraine a guarantee of NATO membership. Everything, or everyone rather, is afraid." End of quote. Why did the US and the EU abandon Ukraine?
Well, they didn't abandon it. I think they have Ukraine exactly where they want. The paradox is that, like some wit said, that America is willing to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. They don't want to escalate. They don't want to send their boys to Russia, but they are more than happy to have Ukraine there as a hostile state, kind of, you know, creating this wedge between Russia and the EU, between Russia and Germany. So that's how they want it. So they are very, very happy with the situation that Ukrainians suffer. Let the world hate Putin while we, you know, unite NATO, while we supply Germany with our gas, while we diminish, say, German or EU capabilities in terms of competitiveness, while we have Ukraine there, which is kind of splits China from EU. And by the way, you know, you Chinese have a very strong position that they should be solved diplomatically. Europeans have to heal their own wounds there in the center. But the United States prefers to be to Ukraine to be kind of abandoned military, because otherwise we're talking nuclear war. But, you know, they will do everything to prolong this kind of misery. They would send their arms, they would send supplies. Again, and I would want to add one more thing. Right after this tweet, which you mentioned, Zelensky tweeted or let know that he is willing to discuss neutrality with Putin. He is willing to stop the war, which was a nice, very intelligent and nice move. Immediately, State Department issued some kind of communique saying that there is no negotiations under the threats and so on, so don't negotiate. So in other words, they don't want peace in Ukraine. They want hostile hostilities to go on in a manageable form.
Interesting. Paolo, you know, there's a British journalist and author, John Loughlin, that wrote an article for The Guardian some 16 years ago in which he drew a very compelling conclusion. Let me just give you the gist of it. He said, "It is better to be an enemy of the Americans than their friend. If you are their enemy, they might try to buy you. But if you are their friend, they will definitely sell you." Do you think that President Zelensky realized this bitter truth?
No, I don't think he realized. He trusted, over-trusted the Western promises and the American ones in particular, believing that what was the path set in the 90s would materialize under his presidency. But it is clear that the confrontation is not... it's unfortunate that the confrontation exists on the ground between the Russian forces and Ukrainian in Ukraine. It's really unfortunate for the people who are caught in the middle. But in fact, the confrontation of Russia is not so much on Ukraine, but is on the Western model, which still tries to impose hegemonic positions while the hegemony is over. And the hegemony is over for a while, because since the Obama presidency, it was clear that we were moving towards a multipolar world and that the axis of interest was no more Russia, but China, and therefore the famous pivot to the east, to Asia, in the U.S. there is a problem, because some of the state structures in the U.S. really geared on the new reality, and others are still steaming up on the old reality. And Ukraine is a casualty of the old reality approach.
Vladimir, in your opinion, did President Zelensky make a sensible decision to put up a fight with Russia? Did he overestimate the US and NATO's support in facing off Russia militarily?
I agree with Paolo that he basically trusted Americans. First of all, I'm not sure that he is that free. You know, I'm not sure that even like German leadership is that free from American pressure, let alone such a weak country as Ukraine. So he, whatever he thought of himself, he basically, you know, cannot express it. So he thought that, you know, United States will be there for him. Well, they are not there militarily, but he trusted them. I imagine that, but I don't know how possible it is, that there will be a strong leader emerge in Ukraine who will sort of position his country precisely in the center of Europe, trading with Russia, trading with Germany, trading with China, and becoming a functional country, maybe on the model of like Finland. Finland didn't express their desires to join NATO, and they're doing very well economically, and they're a powerful, interesting, good country, trading with everyone. So that's kind of what should happen in Ukraine. Zelensky is a weak position. I don't know whether any new politician appear who will challenge United States and say, let me deal with the situation in Europe, with Europeans, rather than with you. We'll see.
Right. So, Paolo, how prudent was it to expand NATO and the EU towards Russia's borders, isolating Russia from its closest neighbors and breaking, you know, the natural flow of post-Soviet societies with hard borders and trade barriers, etc.?
All of this happens in a sort of automatic fashion based on what I said, on this line of thinking that the world is ours because there is no more Cold War, so there is no more ideological opposition to the expansion of liberal democracy and market economy. Therefore, they went on like if nobody would ever arrest them. They didn't notice that meanwhile the Putin system was being reformed and created, and they were loudly saying that they were opposing this kind of expansion. But nobody cared, and we have seen it with Georgia. I mean, it was very clear. Interesting enough, Georgia has not expressed to support sanctions to Russia in this occasion of aggression to Ukraine. So the problem is, if you still think to govern the world, but you do not, then you create side effects which get out of control. And of course, these side effects can be dangerous to certain powers. In this case of Ukraine is Russia. And then they react with the means that exist, which is war. So now the responsibility of what has happened, it's too easy to say it's because Mr. Putin is a maniacal, crazy expansionist. This is not this the case. I mean, they have offered to cooperate in different grounds, but they have been slammed out of the door all the time. And so they found out that Ukraine was becoming a de facto NATO country, supported financially by EU, and therefore this was out of question, was out of the agreements. Let's also talk about this, because when the end of the Cold War took place, there were talks with Kohl of Germany, Gorbachev at the time, and the Americans, and the decision was that there would not be an expansion of the EU and NATO to the Russian borders. Unfortunately, nothing was written down, but there are a lot of evidences of diaries of those who took part in those meetings that these discussions really took place.
Right, lots of verbal agreements that just failed to materialize. Vladimir, just how much are the US and NATO responsible for Russia's war in Ukraine? How much are they responsible for what's going on in Ukraine? Exactly how much? And they rejected Moscow's security demands and landed on its doorstep.
Yeah, they, I think, a great deal. You know, there is a very serious thinkers who write and publish articles about, you know, like that one shouldn't have expanded, including George Kennan, this kind of the founder of policy of containment, when all of a sudden he discovers, you know, he's the dean of American Foreign Studies. When he discovers that, you know, United States want to push NATO, he writes another article saying it's the biggest mistake. We're going to create sort of hostility and wars. Then this politician, last name Burns, he's, I think he now runs American CIA. He published and sent a cable saying, don't do that. We shouldn't do that. So in other words, NATO was deliberately provoking Russia into the situation. I don't know. I think these countries are playing the game of chicken. They are hoping probably that they were hoping that Russia will back off. They were hoping that that Russia will sort of play along. But this is not in the Russian sort of thinking. The paradox is that Russia is a country resisted West for the last 500 years very successfully. So they are willing to go to all kinds of hardship, all kinds of sacrifices to push the West back. And this is the people who, you know, put NATO on Russia's borders, I think, miscalculated, or calculated in the sense that let there be war and let other people suffer. But Russians are not willing to sort of to surrender and play by U.S. Rules. And that's what that's the origins of this conflict.
Paolo, I just want to expand on Europe's role and responsibility here. The conflict is happening on European soil. Did the EU do enough from the get-go to solve the initial crisis and prevent it from snowballing into a full-scale war?
The EU doesn't have the instruments to do what you expect with your question. The EU can support processes of integration of the countries wishing to join the EU system, can promote democracy, human rights, and some kinds of civil society strengthening within the national systems. In terms of effectiveness of European diplomacy, we can say that it is almost null, and we see it everywhere. So the EU, in this case, cannot be blamed. Didn't do anything wrong, a part of existing and therefore doing what is normally doing in the dialogue with neighboring countries.
And Vladimir, what is the cost and repercussions of this conflict for Europe? I mean, is Europe shooting itself in the foot with the sanctions it's imposing, for example, on Moscow?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a loss game for, you know, Russia has to deal with sanctions. It's a very big loss for Europe, you know, starting with the gas, which they now will have to buy for more expensive prices, starting with all this disruption. We're hearing this now, you know, there's no flights. They're banning the flights over Russia. They're banning Russian Aeroflot. So this is like an extremely expensive proposition. And again, unfortunately, it's basically United States. German products are less competitive. They disrupt the trade and integration of Eurasia, that is Europe, with Asia. So United States continues with this policy. And I would add that there is another kind of elephant in the room in all these discussions is China. Whether Russians are, whether Americans want to somehow squeeze Russia before they are ready for the confrontation with China, or I don't know what their policies, but somehow that's their agenda. They need to maybe make NATO stronger because they're foreseeing tensions with China. They need to sort of somehow to weaken the economically their positions. But the United States is calling the shots, while Europe is suffering, Russia is suffering, Ukrainians are being killed, the Russians are being killed. So that's kind of a rather dirty game if you step back and look at it. For the sake of profit, a lot of destruction.
Right. And Paolo, as Vladimir there noted, it's a crisis in Eastern Europe. How do you see the next few days or perhaps the next few weeks unfolding?
Well, this is very difficult to answer because it depends by the evolution of events by the hour, I would say. It's very unfortunate because we can make scenarios, but these scenarios may be changed over the hour, as I said. So the real issue here is that from the U.S. point of view, Russia is not really an enemy because it's no more a threat. The real problem for the U.S. is China. And everything was being directed. We remember also the heavy requests to Europeans to participate in the Indo-Pacific operations and increase their presence over there, and all the moves that were taking place in that area in terms of alliances and so on. I would say that perhaps we can also imagine that what is happening in Ukraine is something that diverts the attention from the area and therefore calms down the animosity against Russia, against China, and concentrates it on the old-fashioned European juxtaposition with Russia and therefore all what is going on. But these are scenarios that are being imagined. Nobody really knows what is in the head of Putin or the Pentagon, and therefore Europeans are caught in the middle, and they will pay a lot, as it was said by the other colleague, in terms of economic costs of this crisis.
Right. And Vladimir, if I can pose that same million-dollar question to you as well, how do you see the next few days or perhaps the next few weeks unfolding in Eastern Europe?
It's a big unknown. I think that I suspect that the Russians will stop within a week their military campaign, but this is just the beginning. They're going to leave Ukraine. What they're going to do, I don't think it's that easy for them to bring some politician who will be good for them, but, will Ukraine accept it? I don't think they can stay and occupy there. This is not their intention. If they back off, It's not quite clear. One hope, ideally that's maybe that was their hope, that Zelensky will make a peace quickly and agreed or not sort of pushing for NATO, and that will be the end of it. But it's not happening. So I don't foresee anything particularly good for anyone in this story.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guests for their time and their contribution. Professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University, Vladimir Goldstein, joined us from Providence in Rhode Island, and Paolo Raffoni, the co-founder and CEO at the CPE Foundation, joined us live also from the Belgian capital, Brussels. And with that, we bring an end to another edition of the Spotlight. This